Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Henry is 30, Claire is 22 when they get married, but they've actually known each other since Claire was 6 and Henry was 36. Impossible, you say, but true in Audrey Niffenegger's best-selling novel, The Time Traveler's Wife. Henry is the first person known with a genetic disorder. It's called chronodisplacement. Claire is left behind to wait while Henry gets yanked from the present into his past and future. In this month's Reader's Review, we take a look at the concept of time travel and its effects on a relationship. Joining me, Jackson Breyer. He's Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Maryland. Freelance writer Lisa Page, former New York Times reporter Leslie Maitland. Do join us, 800-433-8850. This cold has hit my voice. I apologize. I hope you'll enjoy the program. How'd you like the book, Lisa Page?
I liked this book, and I thought it was very ambitious on this writer's part to tell a love story that keeps shifting back in time from the woman's point of view when she's 6 years old all the way into her 80s. And this man who is her lover and becomes her husband and who visits her at all different kinds of ages.
And then disappears with leaving his clothes behind.
Yes.
Just disappears.
Yes.
Did you have a hard time getting into it?
I had a very hard time.
Me too.
Resisted this book. I really didn't like this book initially. I was like, come on. And then finally got to a stage where I just gave into it.
How did you feel about it, Jackson Breyer?
Very similar to Lisa. I think I tend to be a linear person, so it was a great challenge for me as a linear person. But the interesting thing about it, I think, is I think you do get used to it after a while. Like any situation like this, you get used to the shifting times. But also there's a great deal of emphasis on the book on things in the present. I mean, things that you can follow very easily, like deciding whether to get married, deciding whether to have children, the difficulties of having children, meeting one another, the parents, Henry meeting Claire's parents. There are long passages in the book that are fairly standard, easy to follow sections. And obviously you're always aware of the threat that he'll disappear and time travel. But once you get used to the concept, it really is a love story.
How about you, Leslie Maitland?
I really love this book. In fact, I agree that it takes a suspension of disbelief to get into it. But once you do, there is great inner consistency in the world of the book. And I found it tremendously poignant, his relationships, not only with other people, but his relationships with himself, whom he meets on earlier stages of his life, so that in some of the scenes it takes a moment to realize that you actually have the main character, Henry, meeting himself as a child, meeting himself as an older person, in one case, making love with his wife while another version of him is in bed with her, next to her. So the permutations of existence are mind-boggling at times and might, for our listeners, be hard to understand if they haven't read the book. But I would just say that it addresses a theme which is so interesting, which is that past and present, past and future are always part of the present.
You know, I think that for me is really the most fascinating aspect, that we are constantly trying somehow to get out of the present, that we're not living in the moment. That there's always, as you say, both the past and the future in our minds.
Which is, I think she does beautifully. She explains that everything that was past is part of the present, and even when her husband travels to the past, he tells her, there's nothing he can change. It's already happened, and it is already part of what is, which at times is very frustrating and also gives the book a kind of wistful sense of foreboding, because you know that early on that there are tragedies that cannot be averted.
You know, I am interested in the fact that this has been a bestseller on the New York Times book list. It has appealed to a great many people, many of whom, like you and like me, Jackson, who tend to be linear thinkers. But it also occurred to me that time itself is a man-made construct, so that if you are willing to suspend that notion of time moving in a linear fashion, you can be open to all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, I think Leslie said it. It's really about trying to live in the moment, which we all talk about doing, but we have no compulsion to do it in a way, whereas he has a compulsion to live in the present, because at any moment he's going to be jarred away from that present. I think the reason it's popular is because, as I said, it's really a love story about two people. And in a way, and I use this maybe a little exaggeratedly, they're a couple who have a problem, and all couples have problems. I mean, whether it's that one works in a city far from the other, or, you know, maybe one has asthma and the other has to deal with it. I mean, at a very sort of basic level, sure, it's a fantastic problem, and that gives the novel another dimension,
sure.
But they're a couple dealing with a difficulty.
But did the notion of a kind of science fiction get in the way for you, Lisa?
You know, this book really reminded me of another time-traveling book called Kindred by Octavia Butler, where it's also about a man and a woman who are married and who keep getting sent back into the past from the 70s into slave times. And she's black and he's white. So when they go back to slave times, they have to completely change everything. And it's a fascinating device in terms of, you know, looking at our present, the past, and politics. But this book, for me, it was like that, and yet it was more of an intimate story. It was more about bigger problems. Not bigger problems, but personal problems, domestic problems. And the fact that Henry's mother was killed in this car crash, and he's going back to see her.
When he was six.
Yes.
She was killed in the car crash.
Yeah.
And he's going back.
Yes, and over again on Christmas Eve to see this accident where his mother was decapitated. I mean, it's these very personal problems that people have in their lives that we do address over and over again. I mean, it's almost a metaphor in the ways that we go back again and again.
Did you in any way find the narrative of the book and the way she constructed it confusing? Leslie.
I would say there is one central mystery of the book in an event that keeps coming back, which is, of course, Henry's death. And this perhaps is the most confusing part of the book, because we see it from three different perspectives. And only really at the end of the book do we realize that there are two Henrys present at his death. That, I think, you only understand at the end of the book.
Did you understand it that way?
No.
You saw it differently.
No, oh, I didn't realize it.
Because this is what happened.
You read this three
I read
times.
I read this very carefully because I was so determined to understand this one point. Claire, his wife, is 13 years old.
Right.
Wakes up early one morning to hear him calling her name. She rushes out to the meadow on the estate where she lives in the woods of Michigan, finds Henry, a man then in his 30s, no, actually 43 years old, standing with her father and brother who are in hunting gear with carrying rifles. It appears that they have shot a deer. Henry is with them. He motions to her not to give sign that she recognizes him, and she goes back to bed, is sent back to bed by her father. The date is in October, I believe, 84. Later, at the end of the book, when Henry dies, it is January 1st, 2007. He is propelled back to those Michigan woods, and we come to understand that he has been mistaken for a deer by the brother and has been shot. How is it that Henry lived after that? It's because there were two Henrys at that moment in the shooting. I don't know if I'm explaining this well enough, but the point is that when Claire brings Henry home to meet her family for the first time,
they think they know him.
They think they know him mm-hmm. because he was standing with them as a 43-year-old man on the day that they shot what they thought was a deer, but was actually Henry immediately disappearing into the future, wounded, after he was shot.
We should all have Leslie with us when we read this book.
I know, but she went back. I know she went back three times. And even Nancy Robertson, who read this so carefully, said she was informed by Leslie's interpretation. You got it another way, did you, Jackson?
Well, I understood that there were two Henrys present at his death, because obviously he is watching this happen. He knows this happens. And actually, when they go to the spot, all that's there is blood. There's no body there because
exactly.
He's disappeared.
Jackson Breyer, he's professor emeritus of English at the University of Maryland, co-editor of Dear Scott, Dear Zelda. I look forward to hearing your interpretations. Please call us 800-433-8850. Talking about Audrey Niffenegger's novel, The Time Traveler's Wife. It has been a bestseller on the New York Times list. It's now out in paperback. As I recall, she wrote it in 2003,
right.
And it's now out in paperback. Here's an email from Sandy, who says, "Thank you for reading this book. It's been a favorite of mine. My question is this: how did you and your panel feel when Henry told Claire he would see her again as an old woman? At first, I was so caught up with the story, I didn't care. But later, I became angry. Did he really have to do that to her, keep her waiting for him for the rest of her life? Or was it what Claire wanted? Was she so used to waiting for him that for her to live any other way was almost abnormal?
Well, I would say when I read that, I was reassured because her whole life had been about this man. And so it comforted me that she would have another meeting with him in her 80s.
Jackson, read us a passage where Henry expresses his own frustration.
Well, it's right at the beginning of the book. He says, "I can be reading the Sunday Times, coffee in hand, and Claire dozing beside me on our bed, and suddenly I'm in 1976 watching my 13-year-old self mow my grandparents' lawn. Some of these episodes last only moments. It's like listening to a car radio that's having trouble holding to a station. I find myself in crowds, audiences, mobs. Just as often I'm alone in a field, house, car, or on a beach, in a grammar school in the middle of the night. I fear finding myself in a prison cell, an elevator full of people, the middle of a highway. I appear from nowhere, naked. How can I explain? I have never been able to carry anything with me, no clothes, no money. No ID. I spend most of my sojourns acquiring clothes and trying to hide. Fortunately, I don't wear glasses."
And, of course, he steals. He picks locks. He breaks into houses.
He's arrested. He's beaten up. People think
everything.
It's a Hobbesian state of nature here.
Exactly. And, Leslie, tell us how Claire feels.
Claire, and I would just say it's very interesting to note that the whole book is told in there are two voices, always speaking in the present tense, which I found interesting. She says, "Our life together in this too small apartment is punctuated by Henry's small absences. Sometimes he disappears unobtrusively. I might be walking from the kitchen into the hall and find a pile of clothing on the floor. I might get out of bed in the morning and find the shower running and no one in it. Sometimes it's frightening. I'm working in my studio one afternoon when I hear someone moaning outside the door. When I open it, I find Henry on his hands and knees, naked, in the hall, bleeding heavily from his head. He opens his eyes, sees me, and vanishes. Sometimes I wake up in the night and Henry is gone. In the morning, he will tell me where he's been, the way other husbands might tell their wives a dream they had. I was in the Seltzer Library in the dark in 1989, where I was chased by a German shepherd across someone's backyard and had to climb a tree, where I was standing in the rain near my parents' apartment, listening to my mother sing. I am waiting for Henry to tell me that he has seen me as a child, but so far this hasn't happened. When I was a child, I looked forward to seeing Henry. Every visit was an event. Now every absence is a non-event, a subtraction, an adventure I will hear about when my adventurer materializes at my feet, bleeding or whistling, smiling or shaking. Now I am afraid when he is gone."
You know, it seems so unusual that this man, Henry, is an ordinary, wonderful librarian. You know, you'd think he'd have some other more outrageous kind of vocation, but here he is, this ordinary person, time traveling.
But he does have an outrageous situation at the library where they find him naked on a regular basis and they put up this with him doing this.
Because he's so good.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Well, the novel is very grounded in reality and you know, in Chicago, in places in Chicago. His job is very ordinary. I think all that's very deliberate on the author's part to make it. I mean, he has taste in music that is very particular. And his wife has different taste in music, which is, again, an interesting idea about how a couple can have different tastes about things and still care about
exactly.
one another.
Exactly. Let's open the phones and share our conversation with listeners, 800-433-8850, and send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Tucson, Arizona, and to Vicki. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a book that I've enjoyed very much. I've read it and then shared it with my book club, so I've read it at least twice. And while I think it's very successful at keeping this idea that he is traveling through time, I also came to think that it was a giant metaphor for what happens when we're in an intimate relationship, that we move into our partner's past and we move into the future together. and I wonder what your panelist thinks of that idea.
What a lovely thought, Leslie.
Yes, I mean, the idea that once he falls in love with Claire, he wants to be part of her life from the beginning is so touching. And I think that one of the most beautiful parts of the book is the way he deals with her as a child, always being careful not to be too sexual, to just bring her along, to help her learn, to teach her chess, to teach her French, but to try to allow her to become her own person. In fact, at one point she objects and says, "You know, don't tell me what I like in the future, because I want to find
out." She wants to be surprised, exactly. Thanks for your call, Vicki. Let's go to Laura in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. It's so nice to be on your show. I really enjoy hearing you.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
This is just one of those books that kind of changes your life. It made me appreciate my husband of nearly 20 years so much, because Claire was continually feeling the loss of, you know, losing somebody and really never maybe knowing if she would see him again. And I just thought it was an amazing love story. And as a fan of science fiction, too, it was just an amazing melding of the future and the time now, and just being in love with somebody. And how lucky are we to be in love?
Indeed. Love is that ability to accept as part of our lives the past, the future, and
I think it's
present.
Interesting that she called it the time traveler's wife rather than the time traveler, because the emphasis in the book is really on Claire's ability to deal with this situation. Now, it's true Henry has to deal with it too, but he has no control over it. She could very easily say, well, she can't because it's all preordained, but in a way, the emphasis is on her ability to love this man who is so inexplicable. I mean, you know, there's a moment when Henry's father finds out that they're going to get married, and he warns her. He says, he isn't calibrated to bring peace to anyone's life, and that's true. And yet, he does, in a way,
Indeed.
Bring peace to her life.
Indeed. Lisa?
But this book also deals with very contemporary relationships. It's a beautiful love story, but it's also realistic in that you do have adultery, you have domestic violence and suicide happening all around these two lovers.
You know, there is one point that perhaps a great many people would be troubled by. He realizes that Henry realizes that Claire, as a visual paper artist, needs more space. Mm-hmm. They live in a small apartment, and she has decorated it with all of these beautiful hanging pieces. And so he decides to go into the future to find the correct lottery number to return and win $8 million. How'd you feel about that, Leslie?
I felt very ambivalent about that, but I think we're meant to. And in fact, Claire's very ambivalent about it.
You bet.
But throughout the book, he's giving little stock tips to his friends.
Let's go to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
When I first heard the beginning of the show, it reminded me of a short poem that kind of commented on the man-made construct of clock time. And I can't for the life of me remember who the author is. I wonder if anyone there might know. It goes like this. The clock is a crime and a conspiracy against man, and I would not own one, but I miss appointments without it.
Nope. Nobody in here knows the author of that.
No. Well, it sounds like an amazing book. I'll be sure to pick it up on the way home.
I hope you do. Thanks for calling. Here's a wonderful email. This from Gloria, who says, "I'm from West Bloomfield, Michigan. Please help me time travel today. I will be at my book group during your show, but I'll listen to it later. We previously reviewed this book and loved it, but our, quote, willing suspension of disbelief was difficult when the hero appeared in two places at the same time. Please ask your panel how they would explain this aspect of his time travels. Leslie.
Well, at different points in his life, he travels to a place in time, and it occurs in a few spots where he does this simultaneously, coming from two different points in the future. And I actually think she sets this up in the beginning, probably, so that we come to understand it happening at the moment of that scene of his death. But it first happens...
And the scene of the conception of the child.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But early on, Henry travels as a young man to the Field Museum, where he meets a child version of himself in the Field Museum after hours in the dark. And he sort of tries to initiate his younger self into the joys and excitement of time travel and make it a pleasurable thing. They find cookies and they share cookies. He takes him to see some of his favorite exhibits. But I think that this construct is central to the mechanics of the book, that different points in the future, Henry at different ages will travel to the past and perhaps meet up with a former version of himself.
You know, what that kind of reminds you of is the expression when you say, if I only knew then what I know now, mm-hmm. because that's mm-hmm. what happens, as Leslie says. He goes back and meets his younger self, and in a way, what he's trying to do is make that younger self more prepared to be the adult that he's going to
but
become.
But is there any planning involved, or is it totally random where he will end up in the past or future?
Well, they keep talking about a list. Claire's got a list. She's got dates. So, and I have to say I struggled with this because it was like, well, do you have a long list? Or it just seemed like it was a short list of, but then she has the date when she's going to be in her 80s.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's the...
Actually, that is explained. She has a list that she has kept all through her childhood, and after they get married, she gives him the list. Following his appearances,
uh-huh.
She gives him the list once they're adult and married, and then when he goes back in time to her childhood, he's able to give her, the child, the list.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Les.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. That's why I love these panels. We inform each other. Let's go to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Fern.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to say that we don't listen to you because of your voice, but because of how you conduct the conversation, and I really appreciate this program.
Ah, thank you so much.
I read this book several years ago, just after a bad breakup, and I can't tell you how nice it was, and just... It made me feel restored to the hope of love. It was a terrific book, and I really enjoyed it, how they were so bound up together. Loved the book and would recommend it to anybody out there to read.
Oh, I'm so glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi.
Love time travel. I started out as a kid watching Doctor Who and everything else, and this book sounds really interesting to me because I'm interested in how people relate to each other, and time can be a tricky thing. And there's a book that I read called The Man Who Folded Himself, and it has some of the same situations that your panel has spoken about, where he basically experiments with things. I mean, he starts with going to the racetrack and winning some horse races, but then he really starts to think about who he is and when he was born, and eventually he gets to the point where he can't resist finding out about his own death. And what's interesting in that book is that he gets to where he has to keep going back to it. in various incarnations of himself, to where eventually there's a whole wake of himself at his own death. And that's interesting. And
does sound interesting, Kevin. I've made note of it, the man who folded himself. There must be other books out there that do deal with the issue of time travel, but somehow this, in relation to a love story where two people are trying to work out their relationship as well as dealing with this incredible phenomenon.
Yeah, I think your reader who said that she has just broken up in a relationship and this book made her feel better. I mean, I think that's what people get from this book. That's the universal aspects of this book. You sort of scrape away all the mechanism of the time travel. It really is a love story, and there's that incredible letter that Henry writes to Claire before he dies, knowing that he's going to die and when he's going to die, and that she reads after his death. And it's all really a love letter to her after her death.
And really, the child, Alba, is a symbol of their love, which indeed does go on and on. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. Additional support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film Pan's Labyrinth has just been nominated for 2 Oscars. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the writer and director, Guillermo del Toro, about fantasy and real-life horror, and why his grandmother twice performed exorcisms on him when he was a boy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. We're talking about The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. It was originally written, published in 2003. It's now in paperback. It did make the New York Times bestseller list. It's a love story. It's all about time travel as well. Leslie, you went up to the web. You Googled this book. Tell us what you found.
Well, I did find a truly astonishing thing. It was that, as is often the case on the web, one lands in little coteries of people who are absolutely impassioned by something, and there is a person who has compiled a chronology, a timeline of every event in the book from three different perspectives. He has Claire's timeline, Henry's timeline, and then a chronological timeline that blends the two. And with a few little either typos or inconsistencies, it is a marvelous, detailed piece of work.
Gosh.
That for readers who are having trouble following the sequence of events can check back with this. I frankly would advise reading the book first.
Yes.
Before looking at this.
Of course.
But one funny thing was that he asked, and I should credit the compiler of this timeline is named Jack Humphrey. You can find it at http://5wells.com. In among the comments he receives to this is from a person who says, "Thank you so much for having done this, because if you hadn't done it, I would have had to do it myself."
That's wonderful. Here's an email from Brian in St. Louis, who says, "I found this book remarkable. You spoke of being linear thinkers and how it made it difficult to get into the book. I am the exact opposite. I have ADD. And this book was just what the doctor ordered. The storyline jumping from one time to another, from one point of view to another, made this book impossible to put down. My scattered mind was never left to go through events one at a time. The story came together in pieces that developed into a beautiful love story." Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go now to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. Good morning, Lucinda.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Well, I have a bit of a cold. Other than that, I'm fine.
Well, I've actually been doing some time traveling myself, and I see a live remote broadcast here in the Virgin Islands for you.
Oh, that's great. I'll be there.
All right. I, too, have had a problem getting through the book, and I've actually put it down twice, and now I'm really looking forward to picking it up again once I find it in my house. I was wondering what other books the author has written.
I think this was her first novel.
I think it was.
And she's an artist. She's teaching art, paper art at Columbia
exactly.
College.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think you better stick to this one, Lucinda, and then if she comes out with something new, go from there.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks for calling. Let's
Bye-bye.
Go now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I think the whole country's been dealing with that cold, so feel better.
Thank you.
I'm sure your guests and listeners are familiar with Neil Donald Walsh's series of books, Conversations with God, where he really stresses that the three people that we are, our past, our present, and our future, and how we communicate to ourselves back and forth. And I have not read this book, but it sounds fantastic. And it seems like it's probably loaded with a lot of spirituality questions, which I think we're all kind of seeking, you know, to find out why we're here now and what will be our future and how our past affects, you know, what we want to be. And
Lisa, did you see it as spiritual?
I actually did not. I did not. In the way that the caller is talking about, because Henry goes through such a period of his alcoholism and his
womanizing
and when he does sort of pull himself together, there isn't a mention of spirit as the caller is talking, but it feels like that. It feels like he finds a way to cope, but it's mostly through Claire.
There's a moment in the book, and it's very early, and I think it's one of the times when Henry visits Claire when she's very young, and he says, let's see, the choices we are working with here are a block universe where past, present, and future all coexist simultaneously and everything has already happened, chaos where anything can happen and nothing can be predicted because we can't know all the variables, and a Christian universe in which God made everything and it's all here for a purpose, but we have free will anyway, right? And then he says, a year ago, Claire would have said God without hesitation. In 10 years, she will vote for determinism. And after that, and 10 years after that, Claire will believe that the universe is arbitrary, that if God exists, he does not hear our prayers.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's that kind of places this on that continuum. And I mean, I didn't see it as a terribly spiritual.
All right. We have a caller in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Wanda.
Good morning, Diane. I am an avid fan, Monday through Friday, two-hour listener. I sincerely hope you feel better.
Thank you so much. I know I will.
My question is, and I think I just want clarification. I heard, I think you say, that he went back to see his mom when she was killed at the age of six?
Yep.
He was six. She wasn't.
Yeah.
He was six.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, I can get to all of these other points, but that one?
Yeah.
Had a real hard time wrapping my mind around.
I'll
pick up the book.
I'm glad. I think we did confuse you. Yes, he was six when she died.
And you know, one of the sad things is that just as he loses his mother when he is six, his own daughter loses him at the age of five. And just as his own father is left to envy the fact that Henry can go back in time and see his mother alive, Claire is left to feel envious that their daughter can see Henry after his death.
Because she has inherited the same
gene. Right.
And this is why, apparently, Claire has seven miscarriages before a younger Henry procreates with Claire.
Right. Now, I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but I did notice, and I feel that writers don't put things in by accident, that shortly before she has a successful pregnancy, she mentions that their doctor has said that her body has been rejecting all of the previous embryos because it does not view it as part of herself.
Right.
Then she mentions that she has needed several transfusions and that Henry has been donating blood for her transfusions. She's had massive transfusions. And it's only after that point that the seventh pregnancy impregnated by a younger Henry seems to work.
So
I'm wondering whether it's the massive blood transfusions that make her body less resistant to accepting.
Oh, I see. Because it's his blood.
His blood has now become part of her.
What do you think, Lisa?
Well, you know, I kept thinking about, because isn't he also compromised his immune system later on in the book? He's failing.
Yeah.
And so there were all these sort of echoes of AIDS. I mean, the whole notion of being vulnerable or being wide open to other people's blood. And it just seemed to me that she really threw a lot in here.
Yeah, she did.
She really did.
And of course, we should mention that Henry's feet are amputated.
Right.
Right. And early on in the book, he says, without my feet, I'm lost, because never knowing where he's going to land up, he has to be able to run and fight and hide.
Okay, let's go to Oak Hill, Virginia. Good morning, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
One of the things my book club struggled with in this book, and I was wondering what you thought, was why they chose to have a child. Should they or shouldn't they have, knowing, you know, Henry knowing that he would no longer be there?
Well, I think that is part, well, the struggle is twofold. He knows he's going to die young. But it's also that they worry that they will transmit this problem to the child.
But
on the other hand, and I think this is, again, the triumph of love over the obstacles. In the end, they have a child as an expression of their caring for one another. And it is, even though that child does inherit his problem, it is more a symbol to them of the love that they have for each other. So it's yet another instance in the novel where their love for one another is more important than the obstacles that they might face.
But, Karen, if it had been up to Henry alone, I don't think they would have had the child.
But it isn't up to Henry alone.
I know,
that's the whole point of the book.
But Claire wanted a child so badly that she was willing to go through.
Well, and of course, Claire can only know secondhand what Henry goes through,
exactly.
Whereas Henry knows firsthand.
Exactly. So there you are, Karen. Debate even in here.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jared, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me first say that I have a deep respect for what you do on the radio every day and spreading social consciousness and just the wisdom that you bring every day. I listen to you as often as possible.
Thank you.
But I just had a quick question. I have a tendency to always overanalyze everything in my own life and in novels and movies, whatever, and time travel always baffles me. And my question is just about how it affects the things or events that happen before the time travel and after. And the best example I can think of is in one of the Harry Potter movies, Harry Potter is in a certain location and needs to get out, and they don't realize that someone, the headmaster, is coming, and a stone flies through the window somehow, and they realize that something's happening and they leave. Well, later in the movie, he himself goes back in time to change a different event, and it is himself who warns himself by throwing the stone, but the stone was thrown in the first place before they had ever traveled back in time. And, of course, me overanalyzing it just drives me batty. And maybe I just need to study time travel more to understand, but maybe your guest could comment on that kind of event and how it affects time.
Lisa.
But isn't that what we do? Don't we revisit the past again and again and think, oh, I could do this differently. It would have gone differently. Oh, if I had just done
if
this.
If I had known this.
Right.
Leslie.
Well, of course, Henry keeps saying that nothing can be changed going back, that it, things
but
will
always... But he did change.
But he does, it's true, but he does change things. In fact, I noticed even in that little scene where he meets his younger self at the Field Museum, he remembers as a grown-up that the boy loved the Audubon Book of Birds, and remembering that, he shows him that book. So in a way, he has affected the event in the past by introducing the boy to the book that he will later remember having loved.
Yes.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Somebody has written in to say that Kurt Vonnegut wrote about time travel in Slaughterhouse-Five.
We did it on this program, I remember.
Quite right.
But it's slightly different. I mean, the best book I know about time travel is Time and Again, which is a novel that everybody should read.
All right. Here's an email from Mary who says, I absolutely love this book. It led me to daydream about various times in my life, the person I have been and will be. I heard that Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt bought the movie rights to this book. The only reason I was upset they broke up is because I worried that this movie would never be made. What I have heard, Mary, is that Brad Pitt now owns the rights to the movie. He has cast
Rachel McAdams
as Claire, and that they have plans to shoot the movie in 2008. So, rest your fears. We'll eventually have a movie. Do you think it'll be a good movie, Leslie?
I must say, I did keep seeing it as a movie as I was reading it. Yes,
you did.
But I have to say, I cast Daniel Day-Lewis and Julianne Moore.
How about you, Jackson? Do you see it as a good movie?
It could be. And then it could not be. I mean, I think movies can do the kind of thing that we in our imaginations do when we read this book. I hope it doesn't become confusing as it's done in the film. I mean, you know, my linear mind was confused by the book. On the other hand, movies, I think people are more used to that kind of thing in movies, movies like Memento Mori and things like that, that challenge our sense of sequence of time. But it has to be done very, very, very well.
And think about the movie The Notebook with Jenna Rollins and James Garner. That was so beautifully done.
It was, and also this movie that's out right now with Denzel Washington, Deja Vu, deals with this very same. He comes and sees himself. You know, he goes, time travels and sees himself in the same way that this movie
does. Yeah, I think the concept that Leslie was describing earlier of him visiting his earlier self will become clearer in a film than in a way it is in a book. If you can see him as an older Henry visiting a younger Henry, I think that's something the film could do that the book makes. It takes a little bit of suspension of disbelief.
Are you all recommending this book?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Good. That's it. The Time Traveler's Wife. The author is Audrey Niffenegger. Our guests this morning, Jackson Breyer, Lisa Page, Leslie Maitland. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
Wonderful discussion.
Thanks for listening,
everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anderson answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.